Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
The following podcast contains explicit language.
Hi, I'm Stefan Fatsis, and this is Slate's Sports Podcast. Hang up and listen for the week of December 12th, 2016. On this week's show, we will be joined by David Epstein of ProPublica to discuss the blockbuster report detailing Russia's sprawling state-run doping campaign, said to involve more than 1,000 athletes in 30 sports. Then another friend of the podcast, Sam Miller of ESPN, will be here to talk hot stove, all the news from baseball's winter meetings. And finally, we will welcome John Boyce of SB Nation, the man behind the Breaking Madden series, and talk to him about his latest work, an epic dive into the history of the scores of National Football League games. I am very, very excited for this segment. And as you may have deduced, Slate executive editor Josh Levine is off this week. Joining me from Slate headquarters in Brooklyn, New York, is Mike Pesca, the host of Slate's daily podcast, The Gist. Before we chat, Mike.
Yeah.
I'd like to play a clip.
Okay.
Who names their kid Emmett? I mean, Emmett, will you're going to stick with that name, or are you going to change that when you turn 18?
Oh, yeah, I'm definitely going to change it.
What are you going to change it to, Emmett?
No. What are you going to change your name to, Emmett? I know what he's going to change his name to, Guillermo.
No. Yeah. Well, what name are you going to change it to?
Orphan.
Orson?
Orphan. No.
Orphan.
Can I spell it? O-O-S-I-N.
Oh, Orphan.
Orphan.
Okay, at the
Oh, Mike Pesca, those little ragamuffins.
Yeah, those are
those
my guys.
Those little rugrats. They're your guys. Tell us the story of Milo and Emmett. Nay, Emmett, Guillermo.
Well, that was very... So it's a homework helper segment, and I have to say, Jimmy really doesn't help that much with the homework. He just gets them to get into fights, and they taped a segment a couple months ago, and it was very funny. It was very up until the segment aired. They put a lot of work into actually soliciting real homework questions, and then the questions are asked, completely ignored, and Emmett is made to say that he'd like to change his name to Orson, which he mispronounces and misspells, so Jimmy Kimmel thinks he wants to be an orphan.
How did you get them on the Jimmy Kimmel show?
It's secret kind of media.
You guys in the
business. Yeah, you know, I don't want to pretend that. So what happened was, a year ago, we were walking past the Museum of Natural History, and some guy says, "Hey, your kids want to be on Jimmy Kimmel?" And I was like, "Sure." And they did a segment then, and they were funny. Did you see that segment? It was very good.
Did not.
Sports connection, because it was the difference between L.A. and New York kids. And Milo, my oldest, they asked, who's the dumbest person in L.A.? And this was right after the NLDS. And Milo said, the manager of the Los Angeles Dodgers. And literally a day later, Don Mattingly was fired, and he takes full credit for that. So anyway, they were on, and then the producer like, oh yeah, they were really funny. And you should see Emmett in that one. He was talking about growing up fast in New York. And then they did this one, and it was very good. It was very comedic.
It was very good. Very well done. All right, let's whimsy watch. You went to the Cowboys-Giants game. You got any whimsy? It wasn't a very whimsical game.
No, there was a lot of missing of field goals and not even getting first downs. Is 1 for 15 on third down? Is that whimsical? Is Dez Bryant, without a catch in the game, gets a catch, then fumbles it in the last play of the game? That was pretty good. Yeah.
Yeah, not very whimsical. My favorite whimsy of the weekend has to be snow. I love snowfields.
Mm-hmm.
I was very excited when I turned on the TV and I saw the Buffalo. Was it Buffalo Green Bay playing in the snow?
Buffalo, no, it's Buffalo. It was Buffalo Pittsburgh.
Pittsburgh.
And Le'Veon
yeah,
Bell
playing in the snow.
I guess the snow only affected the footing of the Buffalo defense. I mean, when we say walked in for a touchdown, oh my God, did you see a couple of those Bell scores? It's crazy.
But did you see whimsy? Let's get back to the whimsy that the game was delayed. The start of the second half was delayed because they shoveled the field. They snowplowed the field and they shoveled up too many of the rubber pellets. So there were mounds of rubber pellets all over the field and they had to clear the field. And then the players went back to the locker room until they got the pellets off the field. My concern was that the pellets are supposed to make the field softer.
Mm-hmm.
So no pellets, bad field.
Well, snowy, soft field. That did the
there was other the other snow whimsy would have been that the NFL didn't find Rashard Robinson of the 49ers and Randall Cobb of the Packers for making snow angels the previous week.
Or pellet angels. They should make pellet angels.
Pellet angels would have been that would have been a good celebration. All right. On our bonus segment for Slate Plus members, we will address the news that Donald Trump is reportedly considering as the next U.S. ambassador to Japan. Former Chiba Latte Marines manager Bobby Valentine, who would actually be more qualified than many of the people being hired for the new administration. There's never been a better time to sign up for Slate Plus. For Slate's 20th anniversary, for a limited time, we are offering 30% off annual memberships. That's just $35 for a year of Slate Plus with bonus segments of this and other Slate podcasts every week and a lot more. So if you haven't joined Slate Plus, sign up before this offer disappears at slate.com/hangupplus. Earlier this year, a Russian whistleblower exposed a widespread state-run doping operation, culminating with a dark arts operation at the 2014 Winter Olympics in Sochi, in which urine samples were smuggled out of a testing lab in the dead of night. Anti-doping officials followed up on the claims, first with an investigation that resulted in 100 Russian athletes being barred from the Summer Olympics in Rio, and on Friday with a report and mountains of evidence revealing a comprehensive doping program involving more than 1,000 athletes in 30 sports over several years. Also, granules of Nescafe allegedly used to hide tainted urine. Who knew? Nescafe. David Epstein, who covers science, medicine, and sports for ProPublica, is with us now. Hey, David.
Hey.
The chief WADA investigator, the World Anti-Doping Agency, the lawyer Richard McLaren of Canada, said, for years, international sports competitions have unknowingly been hijacked by the Russians. Some of the facts in his report do seem kind of astonishing. More than 1,100 pieces of proof uploaded for public viewing. McLaren said every urine sample from Sochi that he examined was tampered with, around 100 of them, including those of at least 4 Russian gold medalists, and that failed doping samples were covered up for another 15 Russian medalists from 2012 in London. McLaren had issued this other report last summer before the Rio Games, alleging the state-run doping. How far ahead does this new report push the story?
It's mainly more lurid details. I think anybody that had been following it sort of figured at this point that anything that was going through the Sochi lab was totally tainted. And honestly, one of the strangest things here to me is, like, you know, mixing samples with Nescafe. They have male athletes taking urine samples for female athletes. It's in the mouse hole. They're passing samples through a little hole in the wall at the anti-doping laboratory. And when all of that stuff failed, they just reported positive tests as negative because the host country was controlling the anti-doping lab. So I'm like, why didn't they just save everyone a lot of trouble and potential whistleblowers and just report all of the tests as negative ahead of time? I don't even understand why they took all the intermediate steps.
They really overthought this. So to be clear, this was the Russians. This wasn't the Chinese. This wasn't a fat guy sitting on his bed. This was the Russians.
Looks that way.
Yeah. So couple questions. The Sochiness of it, that is what allowed them to at least do the last step where, since they control it, they could define up is down and left is right. But would a country be able to, if they wanted to, go to this extent to try to cheat if they weren't hosting the actual games?
I don't think they would be able to go quite this far. I mean, the Sochi anti-doping lab had lost its certification like several times in previous years. And there was actually a meeting in the lead up to the Winter Olympics in Sochi where, you know, IOC and the World Anti-Doping community sort of discussed whether they could transfer the lab certification to a lab in Moscow to keep it operational. So it was basically like, how can we figure out any way to make sure this lab has its accreditation back in time for the games? And had they not had that, you know, had it gone somewhere to like the lab in Montreal or something like that, I don't think they would have, you know, there's still stuff you can do, but I've seen some translations of secret recordings of some of the people involved in this. And they were saying, you know, one of the reasons they cut a hole in the wall of the anti-doping lab is because they were actually surprised to be getting caught by a new kind of drug testing called the biological passport.
Yeah.
And so I think they would not have been able to, you know, they wouldn't have been able to cut a hole in the wall as easily of a lab if it wasn't kind of, if they hadn't had their own federal aid. I mean, the guy who was running the anti-doping lab was also a Russian, like, secret agent, you know, and the head of anti-doping. I think that would be hard to pull off in another country.
But though, to be fair, the report said that the Russian Olympic team, quote, corrupted the London Games on an unprecedented scale also.
Right.
And it's not. And I would also add that, well, tell me what you think. Was there a Scooby-Doo if it weren't for you meddling kids moment? Or was this thing, how sophisticated was it in terms of trying to actually succeed in the cover-up? Do you think this was destined to fail because there were whistleblowers involved? There was actual physical evidence that wasn't doped far enough. There were, you know, trying to. Everyone knew that the lab should have been taken offline, and they kept arguing bureaucratically, as you just said, that they weren't. So that's my question. Was getting caught inevitable from everything that you have read and seen?
No, I don't think so. I mean, the Russian teams, you know, and certainly Russia is not the only country that's had doping problems, but the Russian, a lot of high profile athletes have had some, you know, they've shown up in with doping problems more often than the next country, in many cases, even before all this stuff, right? So this isn't a brand new thing, but the scale of this, you know, I don't think it necessarily would have come out. I mean, it was, whistleblowers were incredibly disincentivized, right? Like, they have government agents around the anti-doping labs. Everyone's supposed to be on the program. I mean, I've talked to some of the athletes who are involved in this, and some of them feared, you know, like the first whistleblowers that came out had to flee to the United States. Like, they didn't want to come here. They had to leave everything, but they were afraid for their safety. And so I think that's a pretty good enforcement mechanism of not having people become whistleblowers. And even once they became whistleblowers, it was kind of shuffled off by WADA and the IOC. And it took one investigator at WADA, who was then forced out later, to go back and forth to Russia a lot and follow up these allegations. So I think they increased the chances of having whistleblowers by having so many odd steps, but I don't think it was inevitable.
Then how much of this was Russia sensing that WADA was ineffective and taking advantage of it? Sally Jenkins wrote in the Washington Post over the weekend that, quote, the dunces at WADA wouldn't know how to open a childproof pill bottle unless it's got cash in it. The WADA allegedly knew about the state-sponsored doping for, what, 5 or 6 years and sat on it until that whistleblower went public. So Sally's main complaint, and this is one that you pointed out she has made for years since she wrote this Lance Armstrong book, is that it's not about the cheating and it's not about the medals, but it's about the athletes who were forced to dope. They're the victims here. They are human rights victims.
No, I think there's some truth to that. I mean, we can see some Yulia Stepanova, you know, one of the original whistleblowers, like, she shared some information with me about her doping program. And it was like, she didn't even know what she was doing. Like, she was injecting drugs, like, into the wrong parts of her body and stuff like that.
Well, this, you know, is like 1970s East German shit.
Yeah. And I mean, so I do think that, you know, that the athletes in many ways were victims. A lot of them, I'm sure, would not have chosen to do some of this stuff. But it was basically, you do this or you're not on our national team, you know. And as far as WADA, they certainly were tipped off earlier, but it did take them a while to run an investigation because they only really had one investigator. But the other thing I think that's sort of overlooked here sometimes is the head of WADA alternates leadership between, you know, basically someone independent and someone from the IOC over time. And the last couple of years, it's been a very powerful member of the IOC has right. also been the head of WADA. And I think that's also facilitated some of this, because I think WADA for years was actually going in the right, more credible direction under leadership that was much more independent.
One thing that this does is it allows the people who just look at suspicious times or suspicious accomplishments, and without any evidence of who injected what, you know, there's the game of either the athletes or the experts saying, wow, look at that jump in whatever measurable time. Now we can match that up and those suspicions to this investigation. How good were we at just sussing out and raising red flags based on evidence where we didn't even know for sure that doping was happening, where it just seemed really suspicious?
Yeah, it's hard to say. I think there are some legitimately, you know, amazing and world record performances that are not doped. And in fact, I think it's when athletes in many cases do amazing things today, it's even more impressive because they, even if they're doping, they're doping less than the people who were setting these records in like the 80s, basically. But you know, Russia, one of the reasons Russia was so suspicious to people who were following like track and field, for example, for years was a lot of these drugs, all these steroids are analogs, chemical analogs of testosterone, and they work way more powerfully in women. So when all of a sudden overnight a country has like all these female world beaters and their men are still kind of mediocre and getting better slowly, you start to raise an eyebrow if there's no like obvious funding or social explanation for it. And so I think when that kind of happened with track and field in Russia, where all of a sudden overnight you saw this explosion of women's world beaters and not so much on the men's side, that's kind of a pattern you sometimes see when there's like massive systematic doping.
The names of the athletes were redacted from these reports. Do you think that's the right approach here? Are we should we sort of exonerate them from real culpability that they were victims of the state, like we discussed earlier?
Oh boy, that's a good question. You know, I think they were. I do think they were in many ways victims, some of them. At the same time, I think every step of non-transparency at this point is you know, threatens the right, whatever is left of the credibility of this whole enterprise, and particularly to those athletes who feel like they were cheated and saying, like, well, why are these people being protected when I did the things I was supposed to do? So while I you know, I wish we could all have more kind of sane conversations about it, like maybe some of these athletes' names would come out and we don't decide they're the worst people in the world, or we have to disavow them, or the organizations have to disavow them. So I wish everything could be out in the open, but we could also have sort of less hysterical conversations about it.
Well, so people aren't going to get their medals stripped? The fourth place finisher is not going to win a bronze and then a silver ultimately?
No, I mean, in some of those cases, that is going to happen. I mean, the retests, a lot of the retest samples, those people have their names have been out there. And my guess is that a lot of those retests were targeted based on information from the investigation. So my guess is that medals, we've already seen a couple medals that, like, you know, American Kara Goucher, for example, should be moving up to a world championship silver. So I think some of those will be redistributed, but we can't really know how many should have been and aren't because we don't know who it was.
Give me a sense of internationally, who are Russia's allies on this? How much of a pariah will they there be? I know that the big Western European countries are four square against this. I mean, there might be, you know, individuals who are either on the take or not have the best interests of sports at heart. But what's the politics of this going forward?
And let me jump in there and just say that Latvia, obviously a former Russian state, announced that its skeleton federation won't attend the world championships for bobsled and skeleton, which are going to be in Sochi in February.
Yeah, which is totally bananas. I mean, it kind of varies. So there are other countries that have kind of gone low profile, but have had, you know, been non-compliant with world anti-doping standards. Spain, Mexico at times and things like that. Turkey has had labs stripped of accreditation. And recently, you know, when WADA made the recommendation, sort of after, you know, a fair amount of pressure from its own former lead investigator to say, you know, maybe Russia shouldn't be in Rio, there was kind of pushback from some national organizations. I remember Spain was a major one saying, like, well, who is WADA to tell us, like, national federations, the IOC, what to do? And you're kind of like, well, that is sort of their role. But that led to this pushback to say, like, well, maybe we should curtail some of WADA's powers. And you have the head of WADA, who, again, is a high-ranking member of the IOC. The president of the IOC has been, like, as supportive of Russia as any human being could possibly be. He's friends, personal friends with Putin.
Who isn't these days?
No, I know. That's right. It's like dime a dozen there. But, you know, now we've had this, instead of saying, like, hey, we need a more independent body, some of the pushback has been, well, we don't want WADA dictating what we can do, right? I mean, some of these international sports governing bodies, I'm serious, like, not to impugn everyone by any means, but for some countries, I think they're like, where a head of state sends their corrupt cousin so they won't cause trouble in their own backyard, you know? And it's like they have power and they have clout and they have a travel budget and they have absolutely no oversight or accountability, and the trouble that they're going to cause is going to be in some other country.
Right. And in spite of investigations and envelopes of cash and people getting kicked out, there is a persistent belief that the culture continues. Russia's also hosting the Men's World Cup soccer tournament in 2018.
I mean, yeah.
Go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, like, the IOC has made it such that you notice so few countries will bid for a lot of these events anymore, because
right.
it's like it becomes such that you have to pay so many bribes that like only Russia and like Qatar are left in the running anymore for a lot of these things.
Now, you were in Russia right before the Olympics in Rio, and the reaction there to this is that it's a conspiracy, right? That we that this is an American plot to undermine Russia. And given what's happening here with the election, obviously, that's kind of ironic.
Okay, yeah. I mean, this was a shock to me. I hadn't been to Russia before, and I couldn't read there. I wish I would have been able to read their media when I was over there, but I would talk to a fair number of people, and they felt some of them believed there was some doping, but the typical view from my non-scientific survey of just talking to people was that it was like Russia was just doing what America was doing, but with worse drugs, like with older drugs, basically. And that the United States, this was kind of a United States plot to make Russia look bad. And, you know, do you remember years ago? I don't even remember how long ago it was when that sort of sleeper cell of Russian spies got captured in the US. And there was like this one woman who, like, the Daily News made out to be a Bond girl or whatever and all this stuff.
The sexy redhead, sure.
So that was brought up to me twice when I was talking about this, is saying like, this is like that old plot when the United States set up some and claimed we had some spies just to make us look bad and that they caught them and sent them back. And I was like, seriously? Like, there's really some kind of complex going on over there. I that would never have even occurred to me.
Yes, they claim she was a spy. She now lives in Moscow, and Anna Chapman was her name. I want to make another point. Tell me if you have anything to say about this. There's not just a parallel between the Russian hacking with the elections and what what we found out with the doping. The very same groups are involved, often in the very same way. There is a group called Fancy Bear, maybe you heard of. There's a group called Cozy Bear. And these are different levels within Russia of hackers. And they're part of APT, which stands for Advanced Persistent Threat. All right. They're government hackers or government aligned hackers. And then what they do when they get caught, and this is from the Russian playbook, is they engage in smears and disinformation. So if you remember a couple months ago, there were all these WikiLeaks type hacks that revealed that legitimate sports stars had medical exemptions. They published the medical exemption list, and, you know, Rafael Nadal or Mo Farah was supposed to be embarrassed by it. It is exactly what's happening in American politics. The only difference is with the sports and the doping, which I will, even though I like sports, say is not as important as the presidency of the United States, at least the Americans are A, acknowledging and B, upset about it. So what if the president, imagine this as a thought experiment, what if the president of the American Olympic Committee just went on all the news shows saying, yeah, you can't believe this, and we don't know if it was the Russians, and, you know, organized whatever, he doesn't even have as much power as Donald Trump in this analogy, but did everything he could to say, pay no attention to this report. We'd never have reform in that area. That's exactly what's going on in the political arena.
Yeah, no, I mean, I don't, it's... I'm just confused by this. You know, I think I'm sort of reeling in this, you know, what is fake news and era like the next person. And I'm, yeah, I don't know how to make the analogy, but I think that's a good point. And I think there are a lot of parallels, and I really, it's making me realize like why, you know, not that I didn't before, but why, when somebody wants to be a dictator or whatever, one of the first things they do is basically like take over the media.
And one of the potential outcomes is that Russia will continue to deny that there was a state-run plot here, though the evidence is obviously overwhelming. And on some level, there's going to have to be some change and some reform within the Russian sports complex.
Within the Russian sports complex, but not the political arena, because they're getting pushback in the sports context. Yeah, only.
Absolutely, yeah.
I mean, I'm not even sure there's going to be reform. They just appointed Yelena Isinbayeva, who is, you know, one of the all-time great. She's the world record holder in the pole vault, one of the all-time great track and field competitors who was like been one of the most outspoken defenders of Russia and like was going crazy that, you know, that the track and field team was banned from Rio, and they just made her like the overseer of Russian anti-doping. So I don't see if they're going to host these events anyway, right? Like the president of the IOC is going to make sure that if he says, you know, oh, something needs to be done about this, that it only comes after nobody's watching when the Olympics have already happened. Like, what's the incentive for them to do anything?
Right. So the answer could be ban the Russian athletes from competing in Russia.
Right. Right.
And that's obviously not going to happen. David Epstein writes for ProPublica. He is the author of The Sports Gene. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Apple Card is the perfect cashback rewards credit card. You earn up to 3% daily cash on every purchase, every day. That's 3% on your favorite products at Apple, 2% on all other Apple Card with Apple Pay purchases, and 1% on anything you buy with your titanium Apple Card or virtual card number. Visit apple.co/cardcalculator to see how much you can earn. Apple Card issued by Goldman Sachs Bank USA, Salt Lake City branch, subject to credit approval. Terms apply.
Major League Baseball last week held its winter meetings at a Potemkin Village mall and condo fake town called National Harbor, located just far enough outside of Washington, D.C. to make convention goers say, it's too far. I don't want to go to the city. There's a job fair component to the baseball meetings, but in an industry in which 90% of business is conducted via iPhone, it seems silly to make everyone fly all over the place to make and announce trades and free agent signings from one place. In any case, they do it. Biggish name baseballers, including Chris Sale, Dexter Fowler, and Aroldis Chapman, changed jerseys last week. Joining us to discuss those moves and other baseball stuff is Sam Miller, national baseball columnist and feature writer for ESPN. Welcome back to the show, Sam.
Thank you. Chapman. I like Chapman.
Chapman.
I get some grief sometimes because I say fireman, and some people think that that is unacceptable, that it has to be a sort of abridged mn.
And I'm not sure about the Aroldis. I think it's Aroldis in Spanish. Everyone says Aroldis.
Or are you trying
to be? Isn't the default the penultimate syllable is stressed in Spanish?
I don't know. Someone once said Aroldis to me, and I believed them. Maybe I'm wrong. Anyway, you didn't go to the winter meetings, did you, Sam?
No, sir.
No. Why does baseball still have them?
Why does baseball still have them? Well, I mean, you know, there is a lot of business that gets done there that has nothing to do with Adam Eaton. The bulk of business, I think, has nothing to do with Adam Eaton.
Eaton.
So I think that there's some real benefit. Yeah, there's some benefit to having the whole industry there for the, you know, for the minor league operators and for all the job applicants and the vendors. I mean, if you are a vendor selling a new kind of radar gun, there's really no way to peddle your wares so efficiently as the winter meeting. So I think it's most of the action probably happens somewhat outside the
it's a tail wagging the dog thing. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Big signing, I guess, or the big trade was Chris Sale going from the Chicago White Sox to the Red Sox. The Red Sox odds of winning the World Series instantly went to 5-1 from 10-1. Yankees general manager Brian Cashman called Boston the Golden State Warriors of baseball. I think he might have been trolling. Chris Sale's moving to a hitter-friendly park from a pitcher-friendly park. He gives up lots of fly balls. They would be homers in Fenway where they were outs in Comiskey or what's it called now? Arrow Down Park. Or something like that. David Price has had the same problem. Was this a good signing for the Red Sox? Does it change the balance of baseball?
First of all, I think that it maybe isn't necessarily trolling so much as Brian Cashman is perhaps operating on the transitive property, because a lot of people are also saying the Red Sox are now the Yankees of baseball, trading from their deep farm system to get star veterans. And maybe if enough people call them the Warriors of baseball, then someone will put two and two together and decide that Brian Cashman in the early 2000s was actually ahead of his time Maverick genius. I mean, the Red Sox are clearly going to improve by this trade. Chris Sale is, you know, probably the best pitcher in the American League, but it's not exactly like a feat of imagination that they went out and traded for the best pitcher available by trading the best prospect in baseball. Yeah. I mean, it's actually fairly gutsy to trade the best prospect in baseball. That guy almost never gets traded.
And that would be?
That would be Yoan Moncada, who is one of this sort of great crop of young players that Dave Dombrowski inherited from Ben Cherington's bid to build a player development machine And there's a lot of ways to get value out of your young players. Dombrowski recently, as well as more recently with the Red Sox, has seen prospects as very valuable trade pieces that you can use to improve your major league roster by getting guys like Chris Sale. And I wouldn't be that worried about the fly ball aspects or the left-handed aspects of it. I think ideally in a park like Fenway, yes, you'd rather Chris Sale was a right-handed sinker baller, but he's been phenomenal. I think that there's a little bit of a concern that his peripherals went down last year, that he isn't throwing as hard, that there was this story that he was pitching to contact, which maybe he was, but there is also a story that he doesn't throw as hard as he used to. And pitchers generally go in one direction when it comes to throwing hard. And we don't exactly know what the next 3 years are of Chris Sale, but, you know, committing to 3 years of Chris Sale at a bargain price certainly beats giving 7 years to David Price at a record-breaking price.
So you said a lot. I'd like to react in order. One, I definitely think that Yankees brass wants to consider themselves to be the Warriors. The analogy being, years ago, someone saw the three-pointer and decided to organize the Warriors, just like a year ago, someone decided to tell Gary Sanchez, go hit a lot of home runs. It was the same sort of insight and reimagining the game, the genius, the brilliance. Second thing is...
Sabermetrics.
Mm-hmm, that's right. That's what that definition of that word is. Second thing is, if the Red Sox were considering having any kind of restrictive or ugly throwback jerseys, this Chris Sale acquisition puts the kibosh on that. So we're pretty happy about that development. But the last thing is, I want to talk about Yoan Machado. And that is, when he was a Red Sox, all I heard from Red Sox Nation, they're a nation now, is this guy's going to be the best. This guy's a five-tool player. But then when he got traded, I heard a lot of, you know, he's probably destined to be a DH. How five-toolsy is he? And since the Red Sox had this pretty decent DH named Ortiz, who correlated to victory, what would be bad with that?
Wow, I have not heard that he's destined to be a DH, and I am also, you know, not a scout hound. I mostly know what I read by other scout hounds, and Moncada is, you know, he's a DH seems like a stretch to me. He not only plays a position, but he plays prestigious positions. He's played second and third base for most of his career stateside. He is extremely athletic. He is very fast. He has all of those things that make a good defender. So he will probably be a D. In fact, I would say with almost certainty that he will be a DH by the time he is 39 or 40, but there are a lot of years before then. I mean, this isn't the most, being the best prospect in baseball right now is not the same as being the best prospect in baseball 5 years ago. You know, we've seen a huge wave of star young talent graduate to the majors. And so there isn't a, you know, rivalry like there was with Bryce Harper and Mike Trout a few years ago or anything like that. But still, we know from 20 years of, well, I guess we're coming up on 30 years of the prospect ranking era since Baseball America started doing it in earnest around 1990. And there's almost nothing more certain in a young player than a position player who is in the top 10 among all prospects. Those guys don't miss that much. They miss sometimes. There are Brandon Woods out there, but they have a tremendous amount of value, a relatively predictable career path ahead of them. And Moncada won't be paid what he's worth for 7 years. And that carries a lot of value to a team that's rebuilding like the White Sox, but it also carries a lot of value that's not rebuilding like the Red Sox. And they decided that rather than, you know, cash in those 7 years of somewhat uncertainty, they've bet on 3 years of the also uncertainty of a pitcher's arm. I think that the thing about Chris Sale that makes him so appealing is that you don't have to pay him to be good 6 years from now, that you only need him to be good for 3 years. He is good today. That means there's a pretty good bet that he's going to be good tomorrow. And if you look at what the Cubs did in building their championship team, all the long-term investment, all the long-term risk was in position players who were relatively predictable. And then the day they got good, basically, was when they went out and, you know, signed three pitchers and, you know, went out and got a closer. And I think the idea there was, don't bet on guys being good when you're good sometime in the future. Get them when they're good and you are also good. And that defines the Red Sox.
And look at what the Cubs just did, too. They allowed Dexter Fowler to leave, $82 million over 5 years. He was going to St. Louis. They did not re-sign Chapman, who's gone to the Yankees for $86 million over 5 years. And Jeff Passan wrote a piece on Yahoo noting that while management has a lot of tools here, qualifying offers, other ways to try to dissuade players from leaving, players are waiting and cashing in. Free agency is certainly not dead, and teams are being either, you know, teams like the Cubs seem to be pretty judicious about how they're approaching the market now that they've won and built a core, where a team like the Yankees says, we've got all these young guys we can afford to throw some money at Chapman and hope that in 5 years he's okay, even if it's going to cause us some payroll issues in the near term.
Yeah, somewhat judicious. I mean, they also signed Jason Hayward a year ago, and they signed John Lester 2 years ago, and they signed Ben Zobrist and John Lackey last year.
Right.
I mean, the way that you had Jeff on last week to talk about the collective bargaining agreement, and it really does seem like the primary incentive for the players is to keep as much money in the free agent market as possible, even at the expense of 16-year-old Dominican kids or 18-year-old American high schoolers. It is really even more than ever now the only place that you can spend a lot of money if you are a team, and all these teams have a lot of money. So for free agents, there's a ton of incentive for them to get to free agency before they get too old and cash in. And I think that what we've seen a little bit is that the extension boom that happened about five, six years ago, where all these young stars were signing extensions pre-arbitration, there's been a little bit of a pause on that, just because players are realizing that the earlier they get to free agency, the more they're going to be able to cash in on this system that really benefits free agents and almost nobody else.
Yeah, and of those Cubs signings, three of them have been good to, you know, in Lester's case, really, really good. Jason Hayward, I know that the thought was, hey, at very worst, he'll be a great glove, and that is exactly what happened. He has been very worse and not much more than a great glove. But, you know, if you have the ballast of the young players who aren't getting paid that much, you could take one or two of those hits, especially if you're a rich team now like the Cubs.
Yeah, and especially if you have five stars that are all playing in pre-arb salaries.
So right, let me ask you, the Yankees are hoping.
Well, this is my problem with the Yankees. They seem to have a poor grasp of what they're going to be over the next 2 years. They signed Chapman for 5 years, and I would imagine in years three or certainly four or five, they'll be the old Yankees contending. But by that point, Chapman will be the diminished player. So you're paying them all this money, essentially knowing or being reasonably sure that it'll be good for the next 2 years, but I don't think the Yankees will be good for the next 2 years. Why do the Yankees think the Yankees will be good over the next 2 years?
Well, I don't know if they, I mean, if you sign Chapman, it's not as though you're really bankrupting your future. He's, you know, he's expensive for a closer, but he's not expensive for, for a player. Exactly. He's not a guy who you're going to go, well, we can't sign Bryce Harper because we already signed Aroldis Chapman. I think that there are a few reasons that it makes sense for the Yankees to sign him. One is that I don't know for a fact, but even with a no trade clause, players are still tradable. They just have to agree to be traded. And if you look at what the Yankees got their first go round with Chapman and also with Andrew Miller, they signed these guys for money, nothing but money, and they traded them for huge prospect returns at the deadline. It seems like more than almost any other player, the closer's value goes up as the season progresses and more teams see themselves as postseason contenders more teams see the holes in their bullpen. So it's possible that they know that even in year four or year five, Chapman is going to be very easily movable and that it's, you know, possible even that he could be moved before then if he consents to it. But the Yankees it's not like they're a bad team. It's not like they're rebuilding. They won 84 games this year. They were a wild card team the year before. They've lost some pieces, but they have some young pieces coming up. They are a team that has said in the past and that columnists had said about them that you can't rebuild in New York. You can't tear down. And I don't think that they have any appetite to win 73 games. And so even in a season where maybe they're not the favorite, maybe they're in fact now distant underdogs to the Red Sox, they still have to play out the season as though they're one of the contenders. And in a sense, they are. There's no reason to think that this team couldn't win 88 games and a wild card spot.
In which
case, it'd be nice to have Chapman.
I know. They won 84 last year. Their Pythag was 79 wins. I don't know. They outperformed, which is a good credit to them. But I think because they're the Yankees and because their fans expect them to always be good, they assume they'll be good. I liked your point about the brass thinking that they could get value for Chapman. But two questions. One is, what's the history of flamethrowers? I also am going to put forth that they might know that other relievers occasionally get hurt. But since their big experiences was with Mariano Rivera, maybe they don't feel that it's really true. They only know it on an intellectual level that relievers, you know, get hurt or lose their stuff. So what's the history of a flamethrower over 5 years show? And the second thing is, do you have any thoughts on the fact that I know they had him in their clubhouse and they liked him as a person. And yet when you look at just the empirically unassailable fact that he was arrested so many times, and not just for the abuse, but for, you know, whatever, driving 95 on a suspended license and shooting his gun into a wall. Like, you could be the nicest guy in the world, but when those things pile up, I don't know, I would think that that would at least affect the calculation of paying the guy the absolute most that anyone at his position has ever gotten paid.
Yeah, if you and I were running a team, we might think that way, and I wish other teams thought that way. But, I mean, it seems to me that scandals in sports are sort of a lot like scandals in politics, where once they've been litigated once, nobody has really any appetite to litigate them again. And so as long as you can get it in the past, as long as it's a thing that you've, you know, been elected with this over you, nobody really brings it up again. And, I mean, Chapman's value last offseason was sunk. The Yankees got him for a very low cost in terms of prospects. Another trade that had been apparently close to agreed upon with the Dodgers was scuttled. But 3 months later, the Cubs decided that they were going to reset his market, basically, and they decided that he was extremely valuable. And I don't know that a scandal that is more than a year past matters. I mean, if it does, a couple days ago, I happened to be reading, you know, an old piece about Miguel Cabrera, and it was talking about his scandals, his drunkenness, him going into what I think he went into a bar and threatened to, I should look this up before I say, but, like, you know, was like threatening in the bar and everything like that. I mean, he had some really dirty history too, and nobody thinks about it anymore. Nobody talks about it anymore. That is probably not for the good of society, maybe, but that's how teams generally operate when it comes to kind of old scandals.
You know, the biggest mystery of this offseason, I think, is what's going to happen to Ginny Baker on pitch on Fox. The season ended with her sliding into an MRI machine. Possible Tommy John surgery? I don't know. They're keeping us hanging. Were you a pitch watcher? I was. My wife and daughter loved pitch. We watched pitch. Your old employer, Baseball Prospectus, had a weekly pitch conversation between two staffers, which I loved. What's your feeling on Ginny Baker's first season in the bigs?
I watched the first episode and then was only faintly paying attention to it, except because I was reading the BP recaps of it. So I don't know that I know the ins and outs. Like, I haven't figured out what Eric from Entourage's role exactly is, but I gather he's a stat head. Is he a stat head on
the
show?
He's kind of like he's supposed to be the Theo Epstein, like the president of baseball operations, who's brought in, and he apparently was a math guy. But Pitch is very confused about analytics. Eric from Entourage, he's a terrible character. He doesn't seem to understand analytics at all, and he doesn't seem to do any work. His decision-making seems completely spurious.
We hired Eric. We got Turtle.
Right. They shut down Ginny Baker near the end of the season during a playoff run because some analytics intern who was despised two episodes ago as a total goof comes up with some theory about the strain of throwing the screwball and the drop in her spin rate. So, yeah, Eric is a weak link on the show. Not doing analytics any favors, I got to say, on Pitch.
Yeah, not doing analytics any favors, but also in the episodes that I've watched, it doesn't do a lot of favors to the old school either. It seems to me that the show is very intent on establishing Ginny's agency as a character, which I think I like that. I think that's really great. And so in the sense that any dogma or any philosophy or any ism is seen as basically a source of conflict that is threatening to take away her agency, everything is pretty much a, you know, potentially a supporting character that is doomed to be defeated by Jenny Baker. So I am I'm not too defensive of stat headism in primetime television, but I think in this case it suits the character and it suits the story just fine, at least with my kind of two-thirds understanding of the plot.
But why'd they make her pitch a screwball when they could have just made her pitch a knuckleball and that would have been much more plausible?
That's oh, you problem. Couldn't throw a knuckleball. You couldn't have, if you had her throwing a knuckleball, then she would just be an exception to the sport as a whole, right? It wouldn't be athleticism anymore.
Oh,
it would be,
so the gimmickry.
It would be gimmickry. Yeah,
exactly. Exactly. Yeah. And so they had to have her. I think it was right that they had to have her throwing with a major league repertoire. And a screwball is a nice pitch that you don't hear about very much. And you know, the great thing about the screwball is it has the word screw in it, which makes it sound screwy. And to the fan who is watching the show but doesn't know a whole lot about major league pitches and spin rates, screwball is just, I mean, screwball is a term so good that they would have had to make it up for this show if it didn't exist.
That's right. Yeah. They could invent whole genres of film about screwballs.
Yeah, comedies, maybe. Mm-hmm.
That's right.
sounds promising.
Sam Miller writes about baseball for ESPN. He is the co-author with Ben Lindbergh of The Only Rule Is It Has to Work, Our Wild Experiment, Building a New Kind of Baseball Team. They cut Aroldis Chapman, I think, right? You didn't sign him. You refused.
we had some baggage on our team. I will say that when it came time to actually make decisions, we might have turned a few cheeks that we might have... otherwise, not.
Didn't you sign that reliever with 83.4 tattooed on his forearm?
What?
The soft tossing lefty who decided to.
That's how fast he throws and drives.
Thanks, Sam.
You're welcome.
This podcast is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Most of you listening right now are probably multitasking. Yep, while you're listening, you're probably also driving, cleaning, exercising, or maybe even grocery shopping. But if you're not some kind of moving vehicle, there's something else you can be doing right now: getting an auto quote from Progressive Insurance. It's easy, and you could save money by doing it right from your phone. Drivers who save by switching to Progressive save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Discounts for having multiple vehicles on your policy, being a homeowner, and more. So, just like your favorite podcast, Progressive will be with you 24/7, 365 days a year, so you're protected no matter what. Multitask right now. Quote your car insurance at progressive.com to join over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
Listeners of this podcast know that I am fascinated by the scores of NFL games, but not routine scores like 20-17, the most common final score of the more than 15,000 games played in the league's 96-year history. In fact, there was another 2017 game on Sunday. No, I am talking about scores including numbers like 2, 5, or 11, and especially scores that have never occurred before. According to Pro Football Reference's indispensable all-game scores page, as I speak, there are 363 final scores of up to 50-50 waiting to happen, including every possible score involving a 4, except for 10-4, which occurred once in 1932. But I digress. I was thrilled and relieved to learn that I'm not the only one transfixed by the mathematical beauty, probabilistic mystery, and epistemological wonder of weird NFL scores. And it is no surprise that that person is John Boyce. John is the creative director of SB Nation Labs, the man who brought the Madden video game to its knees and talked about it on this show, and now the John Nash-like genius behind Scoregami, a 20-minute video exploration of the history of NFL game scores, and a very cool chart, too. John, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much, Stefan and Mike. I'm happy to be here.
You define Scoregami as, quote, the art of building final scores that have never happened before in NFL history. We had some almost Scoregami on Sunday. Tampa, New Orleans held some hope for a while. 20-11 was in play. 22-11 was in play for a while. But it was not meant to be. Final score was 16-11. That had happened once before in 2014. My obsession with weird scores dates to 1970, when 7-year-old me was watching the Cowboys beat the Lions 5-0 in a playoff game. How did you get hooked?
I actually kind of started with the number 11, which is what we saw yesterday with the Saints. The number 11 in football is a really disgusting number because it means probably no touchdowns being scored. Probably it means three field goals and a safety, which is just kind of grotesque. It was interesting to me to look at a number like that. Like 11 in any other sport is not a hard to get to number, but the math of NFL is so weird that you can only score 6 or 3 or 7 or 8 points at a time that it's almost like an unscratchable itch.
Let's talk about 11s. There are a few ways to get to 11s. You mentioned 4s. Have you done an analysis of games with 2 safeties? And when there are 2 safeties in a game, does that really open things up? Is that where the scoregami juices get the most flowing?
It can, yeah. It's interesting. This is where the math gets interesting as well, because if you get 3 safeties in a game, that's 6 points, and you get 6-point blocks all the time in scoring. But if you just get 2 plus no other scoring, that would be 4 points, which is almost, that. As far as my research goes, that's only happened once in the entire history of the NFL. And to score exactly 2 and to have the offense score exactly no points, like to score 2 safeties and that's it, the odds of that are just astronomically rare, to the extent that I don't expect to like ever see it.
Well, speaking of that, the holy grail of scoregami would be a 4-4 game. And you do the math in your video, and it really is something. So let's listen to you describing the math of a 4-4 outcome.
On average, a team scores a safety every 32 games, so the odds of scoring 2 in a game are about 1 in 1,000. The score has to stay at 4 points, so the offense has to be shut out. The odds of that are about 1 in 70. So for a team to finish with exactly 4 points is about 1 in 74,000. Now, for this to happen to both teams in the same game, the odds of that would be 1 in about 5.5 billion. Of course, we're still not done because these odds only get us to the end of regulation. This overtime has to be scoreless, right? So the odds of a completely scoreless overtime are about 1 in 87, which means the probability of a 4-4 final score is about 1 in 471 billion games. There are 267 games in a season, so if NFL rules and behaviors never changed, we could expect to see one 4-4 game every 1.7 billion years. Hey, you know what? That's pretty good news, because we should have about 4 billion years before the surface of the Earth gets melted off by the heat of the sun, so there's plenty of time.
So at least 2 4-4 games are in the Earth's future is what I take away from that.
I would hope so. I mean, you know, there are a lot of things that could go wrong between now and then. There's a chance I might be dead before we reach year number 4 billion. But I see a score like that, 4-4. Those are such average regular numbers, you know. It's I think, more likely that we'll see a complete change in the structure of the NFL. I think it's more likely that a team would do that on purpose to be funny than to just have that happen organically.
Well, you point out that there are some coaches that seem to be scoregami sensitive. Jim Harbaugh, Bill Belichick. Pete Carroll, though, he's had 7 scoregami games since 2010. He won all of them, including the 43-8 Super Bowl, which had there'd never been a 43-8 game before. I think Carroll is totally doing this on purpose, and I think someone needs to ask him if he's aware of that.
Yeah, I'll tell you, like, if I were to do it on purpose, this is pretty much how I would do it. I would have a Super Bowl scoregami, and I would do exactly 1 every season, which is what he has done in all 7 of his seasons, and I would win all of them. Like, honestly, scoregami is sort of he's sort of the pilot of the scoregami, and he's the one that sort of, his Seahawks are the ones who always sort of put this little penny on the tracks that makes, you know, the railroad, like, snap off of it. So, you know, for example, in the Super Bowl, it started on a safety in the first play from scrimmage. And that just sort of set the table for everything else that happened after it. So he's kind of, you know, even if it's not intentional, he is the architect behind all of these wins, which I find amazing.
You might say there's a conspiracy there with Pete Carroll. I don't know.
Absolutely. I don't know. Pete Carroll, as I recall, believes in some conspiracy theories himself.
So I thought that maybe Chip Kelly might help with the scoregami because, you know, he loves to go for 2 and get high scores. But his offenses have just been so bad, he hasn't been able to work his whatever potential magic he had or what magic he brought to the college level with the weird Oregon Duck scores.
Yeah, you know, there are a lot of scores involving 0 that have never happened. So maybe if his offense keeps being terrible, there's some potential there.
Would you rather see, is there a holy grail? Is 0-2? 4-4 is great, but what about 0-2?
Yeah.
Oof. 2-0 has happened. It's happened. It happened in the early days of the NFL, back in, you know, the 20s, when the forward pass was there, but it wasn't really used that much. There was a lot of, I mean, there were 0-0 ties were actually pretty common, more common than like 2017 today.
I think there were, what, 5 scoreless ties and a 2-0 game in 1922.
Yeah, yeah. And there was a if I recall, I think it was 1932, the year the Chicago Bears, their first 4 games, the scores were 0-0, 0-0, 0-0, 2-0.
Yeah, it's amazing that football didn't sweep the nation immediately. Okay, it's now possible to score 1 point, right?
It is. It's insane.
Good question, Pesca. This is what John, I'm going to step on John a little bit. This is what John calls dark scoregami. Tell us about dark scoregami.
This, I call it dark scoregami because it's one of the few ways that you technically can score according to the NFL rule book, but you really shouldn't if something has gone horribly, horribly wrong if you have. It takes a little bit too long to illustrate in full, but basically you would need to score a 1 point safety while on defense during a 2 point conversion. So basically, you know, obviously during a 2 point conversion, you're playing defense. The offense has the ball at your 2 yard line. So you have to get a safety 98 yards in the wrong direction.
Yes,
now
you
would think like, you can't just take the ball and run it 98 yards. You have to make them do it, which how that would ever happen, I can't exactly tell you.
Pete Carroll. Well, it would happen if, right, the only way it could possibly plausibly happen is that if the defensive team picked up or intercepted, ran it all the way down, somebody caught him, fumbled, recovered in the end zone, safety. Fumbled out of the back of the end zone, yeah.
That or, and that even seems less likely than a first scene from the Last Boy Scout scenario where somebody at halftime gets a call from like a bookie and is like, you have to score exactly 1 point in this game. And they do it like that.
Scoregami, the screenplay.
If they do, we know where the investigators are going to focus their attention, John, right on you.
John, you point out there have been 3 scoregami spikes in NFL history. One was 1946 when the All-American Football Conference was founded. So you had more teams, more games. The second, 1960, the American Football League was founded and the AFL allowed 2-point conversions. They had some awesome scores, 43-43 in 1964, the highest tie ever. And the third spike was 1994 with the addition of the 2-point conversion in the NFL, which you note saved the art of scoregami because really the league had settled into these scoring patterns. There was only one new score in 1992. Do you think there will be another change in scoring? Because there have been historically changes in the scoring rules in the NFL. And B, what do you think the likeliest scoregami to come off the board is going to be?
Well, I feel like the NFL is so hesitant to change and they so want to cling to the old ways. Like for the example, take the point after touchdown. You know, it's kicking used to be, you know, 100 years ago, kicking was the point of scoring. It was touchdowns are what you got to get to the kick.
Well, I think at one point there was a 5-point play in the NFL. You got 5 points for scoring.
Yeah. I believe it was a 4 or 5 point field goal. And like this thing at this point, kicking is almost like an appendix where they just won't get rid of it. And they keep trying everything, including moving the extra point distance back. So, you know, even then it only takes the percentage down from like 99 to 95 or something like that. Mm-hmm. So I think they're so hesitant to get rid of it that I kind of don't see them making any major changes. It could happen. As far as the most likely scoregami to come off the board next, there are a lot of territories out in like the sort of like 40. See, 40 is a pretty ugly score to get to mathematically based on the little 7 and 3-point blocks you got. So something like, you know, 40-33. I don't have the numbers in front of me.
I've got them in front of me. Yeah, you got 40-25, 40-31, 40-36, 40-40. 40-12 would be tough.
Ooh, 40-12. Yeah, that'd be terrible because what that means is that the 40 team is racking up so many points in weird ways. And then the 12 team is like, well, let's kick a lot of field goals to catch up. So that's just not happening.
I just want to go back and amend something. It does, the one-point play apparently doesn't have to be that 98-yard scenario. It can be the team blocks the extra point, retreats out of the end zone, then runs back into the end zone, you know, to try to gain an advantage, is tackled in the end zone. That's 1 point for the kicking team.
Yeah, that is 1 point, but the thing there is that
that's
basically
for the kicking team, Mike. So they would have already scored six.
God damn.
Yeah.
So that just gives that's tethered to the 6 points they had to score to even get that play. So it's really just 7 points, but it's a very weird way to score.
There really is a sort of a refusal to even acknowledge the existence of this scenario. Even on the Pro Football Reference page of missing scores, they don't list 6-1 or 8-1 or 9-1 or 10-1 or all the ones.
Yeah, what's really interesting is the NFL in general is so allergic to the number one that if you say you're an NFL team and you forfeit a game, that means the other team wins by a default score of 2-0. They just give them 2 points to just signify that they won. They could just do one, but they don't because they're so scared of the number one.
Yeah. Well, you know what would help here would be the Rouge. And as everyone knows, I'm a huge fan of the Rouge, the Canadian 1 point score when the punter kicks it out of the end zone.
Oh, sure. And, you know, the CFL has been around, you know, roughly as long as the NFL have. That, you know, Canadian American football kind of are twins that grew up around the same time. So who's to say who has the correct game? I mean, the 1 point Rouge is kind of awesome. Just kick it far as hell and see what happens.
Yeah, John, you got to do Canadian scoregami and see what's going on up there in Canada.
I'm going to need about 27 million slide rules to pull that one off, but I should.
Mike, you got anything else?
Oh, I think we've, I very much enjoyed our conversation, but I think we've exhausted it. What do you think?
I don't think so.
I know, but I'm trying John to pull you back from the abyss.
John and I could probably take this private and we could go for a while here.
Pretty
oh,
soon,
absolutely.
If you look at the listenership of the podcast, you will have taken it private.
I will point out, I mentioned the 20-17 at the top. It is so far ahead statistically of the second most frequent score, which is 17-14, that it almost seems anomalous.
Yeah, it's odd. And we were kind of talking a little bit about this earlier, but my only hypothesis, and this is just kind of a shot in the dark, is that it's just way more common to have, say, seven scores than it is to five, just based on the tempo and the number of possessions you usually have. Mm-hmm. It's like it's 251 for 2017 and 193 for 17-14. So it's a weird deviation, but I guess it's just as long as they're hanging out on the field, they may as well score a couple more times.
All right, I'm rooting for 11-11 in the playoffs. It wouldn't be in the playoffs. We'd have to go 11-11 and then that wouldn't work. 12-11. Yeah, 12-11.
12-11 works.
12-11 in the scoregami. Yeah, we could do that.
Pete Carroll figures to be in the playoffs this year, so I'm going to go with 2.5 to -4.
Pesky, you got a prediction for a scoregami? Just give us what you think might be a scoregami, and I will check and see if it is indeed.
Well, I did notice that a lot of the 1 point games, like 12, it does seem that 12s and 11s happen rarely, but they do happen. But 12 against 11 has never happened, right? It seems like a lot of 1 point games don't
all
happen.
Right. I think we all need to pick one score that's going to come off the board next. I'm going with 25-18.
I'm going to go 40-25.
Ooh, that's good. I'll go 12-11.
John Boyce, he's the creative director of SB Nation Labs. You can read about and watch his video on Scoregami at SBNation.com.
Okay, round two. Name something that's not boring.
Laundry? Ooh, a book club. Computer solitaire, huh?
Ah, oh, sorry. We were looking for Chumba Casino. That's right. Chumbacasino.com has over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
And now it is time for After Balls. Mike, do you know who ordered and who scored the first 2-point conversion in NFL history? If you know the answer, don't say it, and let's just listen to this.
Way to go, offense!
Then Bill Belichick became the first coach to call.
From the hold of Tom Tupa, they go for two.
And Tom Tupa, the first player to score a 2-point conversion.
Oh my, what a play!
Did you know that?
That's awesome.
The Browns punter, Tom Tupa. First week of 1994, he scored two more 2-point conversions and gained the nickname 2-Point Tupa.
Well, that nickname is unavoidable when you're Tupa, and that happens.
He was born to have that nickname. Maybe the NFL changed the rule just so Tom Tupa could be nicknamed.
Yeah, maybe it was just a stenography mistake, you know.
A Tupa
conversion became a 2-point conversion.
Mike, what's your 2-point Tupa?
So I was reading about the 1991 Orange Bowl, which of course ended 10-9, an unusual score, but not unprecedented. And in that game, a clipping penalty caused Rajib Ismail's punt return that would have won the game for Notre Dame. That was called back. But here is a note at the bottom of the Wikipedia article about that page. Two players named Charles Johnson played in the 1991 Orange Bowl for Colorado. One of these, the backup quarterback who was named co-MVP, is mentioned in this article. However, this player never played in the NFL and has no Wikipedia page because he is deemed non-notable. The other Charles Johnson, who was a wide receiver in the 1991 Orange Bowl, but is not mentioned in this article, is deemed notable because of his NFL career and has his own Wikipedia page. This can be read as totally without bias, without fear, without favor, just factual. Yet I see anger in this note. I see an injustice being expressed in this note. I see in this note a cry for fairness. So that was one Wikipedia note that I came across. Then, and I'll tell you how I got to my next Wikipedia note, I was listening to Mike Francesa talk to Ron Darling, and Francesa was talking about two great players, and one of the best Mike Francesa name that I've heard in years, Rico Caudy. He was talking about how great Rico Caudy was, what a great young player, Rico Caudy. Yes.
Yes.
Lula Morello, that is the perfect Mad Dog name, and Rico Caudy is the perfect Mike Francesa name. But they were talking about another great or near great of their era, Richie Allen. And then they were talking about Dick Allen, and I got confused because I knew about the young Philly slugger, Richie Allen. And then I knew
Richie
about...
Richie, call me Dick Allen.
I didn't know this
whole... That's what he once said.
Right. I didn't know this whole story. So Richie Allen became Rich Allen and then wound up as Dick Allen. And there is a baseball card breakdown.blogspot.com. Just scrolls through all Richie Allen's cards until... And so you see the evolution of how Richie became Dick. And so I was wondering, when did this happen? And I went to the Wikipedia page, which is not the Richie Allen page. It is the Dick Allen page. And I came across this reference. Musical career. Do you know anything about this, Stefan?
No.
Dick Allen sang professionally in a high, delicate tenor. The tone and texture of his voice has drawn comparisons to the Harp Tones lead singer Willie Winfield. During Allen's time with the 60s-era Phillies, he sang with a doo-wop group called the Ebonistics. Ebonistics? You know, Ebony, Ebonics. I'm not sure which way they were going for. Probably Ebony, so Ebonistics. Dick Allen and the Ebonistics sang in the Philadelphia nightclubs. And here is this my favorite part. He once entertained during halftime of an NBA Philadelphia 76ers game. The Inquirer printed this review. Here came Rich Allen, flowered shirt, tie 6 inches, 152 millimeters wide. I don't know if that was in the original Philadelphia Inquirer review or the Wikipedia changing it and giving us the metrics. Hip hugger, bell bottom pants, a microphone in his hand. Rich Allen, the most booed man in Philadelphia from April to October, when Eagles coach Joe Kuharich takes over, walked out in front of 9,557 people at the Spectrum, still drawing those crowds at the Spectrum, to sing with his group, the Ebonistics. A most predictable thing happened. He was booed. Two songs later, though, a most unpredictable thing happened. They cheered Rich Allen. They cheered him warmly as they have ever cheered him for a game-winning home run. So he had a great talent. He didn't always make do on his talent. He was rich. He was Richie. He was Dick. But it was with his high, delicate tenor that he eventually won over the Philadelphia crowd.
There are websites dedicated to the fact that Dick Allen, Rich Allen, Richie Allen is a difficult baseball card to collect because of his constant name changing.
Yeah. Can you think of others? I remember Jeff Leonard became Jeffrey Leonard. And
One Flap Down.
Yes. Yes. But I can't remember, you know, Jeff to Jeffrey to Jeffy. I can't remember a three name changer.
Maybe change it to G-E-O-F-F.
Yeah, Joffrey, King Joffrey Leonard.
Exactly.
Stefan, what's your two-point tupa?
The childhood voice of my favorite baseball team, the New York Yankees, was the Scooter Phil Rizzuto, the Hall of Fame shortstop. Scooter was best known for talking about cannoli and his wife Cora and leaving the booth early to beat the traffic back to Jersey over the George Washington Bridge. I think I mentioned once before that his disjointed words were turned into a book once, Oh Holy Cow, the selected verse of Phil Rizzuto, in which the writers Hart Seeley and Tom Payer took the Scooter's play-by-play and set it as poetry. It's brilliant. Now, Josh, just the other day, was roaming around the Internet Archive doing some research, and he alerted me to a find in the 1970 to 1979 Radio News Archive. It is labeled Phil Rizzuto on Lightning. It's from August 8th, 1974. The Yankees are on the road against the California Angels. Let us listen, and we'll pause for commentary.
Egan is given an error. And the Yankees get a light. Uh-oh! Holy cow! As they put that error sign up, a bolt of lightning. Now you hear the thunder right in back of the scoreboard. Outside. And that's where I'm heading in just a moment. Only there's nobody here to take this microphone over. Al Brown can't do it because of the union rules. And the crowd is starting to scatter now. The pitch is hit in the air to deep right center, but moving to his left is Nettles. And Morris Nettles makes the catch. One out.
All right, now, Rizzuto took a lot of shit for his scatterbrained play-by-play, but this is brilliant. He calls the pitch outside, and then he says, that's where I'm going. What a segue, don't you think?
Wait a minute. Morris Nettles?
Yeah, not Greg.
Oh, okay. Morris I was wondering Nettles. Why Greg Nettles was. Holy cow, White. I love when he talked to White. White.
We got that coming up.
Right, we got it coming up. Here, 19-2.
It's coming up.
You should have seen that bolt of lightning. Holy cow. The whole crowd saw it. Yeah, Bill White's trying to now. If Bill White was any kind of a buddy, he'd come over and grab this mic.
Now, Bill White, you mentioned, White was the second color man for the Yankees. He was a former player. He worked alongside Rizzuto from 1971 to 88. He became National League president in 1989, appointed by Bart Giamatti. In the booth, he was Rizzuto's foil, as Pesca just
indicated. Holy cow, White!
And he was his straight man, and Rizzuto always called him White.
You saw that lightning out there. I know you did.
White's not talking.
I want to tell you. There was another bolt and another clap of thunder.
This is great because, like, right there, all the catchphrases and ticks that Rizzuto employed. Holy cow. Yeah. I want to tell you.
I
want to tell you all the time. I want to tell you. And then the interplay with White was classic. Rizzuto was always asking everyone around him to do shit for him, not because he was a pain in the ass, but because he was so innocent and so goofy. And everybody played along because, A, Rizzuto was easily played, and, B, everybody that loved him, and they knew that it made great radio.
And Dick Williams is coming out now, and they might, holy cow, what a bolt of lightning. Dick Williams might want to walk Maddox to pitch to Bobby Mercer. And if he does, poor Bill White, what a buddy you are.
Rizzuto never says what Bill White actually does.
No.
And that's also classic Rizzuto. He would say stuff that made no sense on the radio because he'd be talking about something that only he was seeing or thinking, and then he wouldn't explain what was going on.
And let's see what they're going to do. If they're going to walk Maddox, because he is red hot right now. They're going to walk him. They're going to put Maddox. Oh, there's another one.
A jumpy man.
He does it again.
Yeah.
He's trying to care about the game, but he clearly is completely freaked out.
He's so much better as announcing the weather than announcing baseball. It's amazing.
And I want to tell you, this lightning is really hitting all over this ballpark. And more fans are scattering. And Dick Williams, of course, realizes that if the rains come now and the game is called, it'll be a 1-1 game. But if the Yankees should get a base hit, even though this inning is not completed, the Yankees would win it. And here comes Bobby Mercer. Now, Bobby's been up twice and struck out both times. Two out.
All right, the fact that it's Bobby Mercer, who was my hero, makes this the perfect clip for me. Now let's listen to the conclusion of Phil Rizzuto on Lightning.
Pitch. Line drive, base hit, left center. That's going to score two runs. Two runs will score, and the Yankees lead 2-0.
All right, the Yankees did not go ahead 2-0. Then you may have caught earlier in the recording, Rizzuto saying the score was 1-1. But after Mercer's hit, Scooter said that they were ahead 2-0. I checked retro sheet. It was indeed 1-1 at the time. Elliot Maddox and Sandy Alomar scored on Mercer's hit. The Lightning apparently did not strike the stadium because they got all nine innings in. The Yankees won 3-1. Pat Dobson with the win. Frank Tanana, at the peak of his sexual prowess, as discussed in a previous After Ball, took the loss. Now, it turns out that Richard Sandomir of the New York Times also had heard this audio and wrote about it after Phil Rizzuto died in 2007. He said he was sent the clip by a guy named Paul Doherty, a talent agent who had kept a library of Yankees audio. Commenters to his post on the Times website remembered other times that Rizzuto was terrified of lightning in the distance. He thought the broadcast booth could conduct lightning, apparently. One commenter remembered that Rizzuto explained his fear of lightning once during a game. Quote, apparently he was playing minor league ball in Kansas City as a young man when a bolt of lightning struck and killed the center fielder, the commenter wrote. I have not verified that anecdote, but I do want it to be true. Not that the guy died, the center fielder, but that would be why Phil Rizzuto was so scored. We'd love your feedback on what we talked about today. You can email us at hangup@slate.com. We'll also gather links to the stories we discussed at slate.com/hangup. Please subscribe to Hang Up and Listen in iTunes. You can find us by going to itunes.com/slatepodcasts. And when you're there, leave us a comment and a rating. Please become a fan of Hang Up and Listen on Facebook at facebook.com/hangupandlisten. I think at some point we should ask listeners, we should give a quiz to what all the URLs are that we read every week.
Yeah.
Our intern is Shane Monahan. Our producer is Mickey Kapper. The executive producer of Slate's podcast is... listeners? Who is it? Steve Lickteig. Andy Bowers is the chief content officer of Panoply. Hang Up and Listen is part of the Panoply Network. Check out our entire roster of podcasts at itunes.com/panoply. Remember Zelmo Beatty, and thanks for listening.
Remember Zelmo who? Thanks for what?
Remember Zelmo, just like we should put blanks in there, yeah.
Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.